It would appear that the curse of Babel came upon men when they first began to think. Their minds are now normally in a state of such continuous motion that the power to rest them adequately has been lost. When the brain is weary of its never-ending thoughts and the heart is tired of its ever-changing moods, when the world tires both and nerves are frayed, our great need of mental rest and inward peace is manifest, and this can be partly satisfied through the habit of calm meditation. A certain system of memory training found a host of purchasers throughout the world in the years during and after the 1914-18 war. Nowadays, many distressed people who are overwhelmed by troubles would like to buy a system on the art of forgetting. Count Kieserling has ventured the prediction that the very materialism of Western civilization will drive it at least into the reaction of mysticism, and few competent observers will disagree with him. We are caught like squirrels in the revolving cage of this world. We climb the steps of that turning cage thrilled with the illusion of incessant activity. The wiser ones cease their climbing now and again, rest interiorly and save their strength. They go farther than we do, for they at least reach a measure of peace, and we? The discipline of mental quiet was discovered thousands of years ago, yet holds just as true today in this era of mechanical marvels and auto-filled streets. It still shows man how to let his faculty of attention work for him, and not against him. These psychological advantages have nothing to do with the religious side of meditation, although most mystics would deny such a statement. They cannot but do otherwise because their approach is prejudged, biased and unscientific. Nevertheless, the impartial investigator may find for himself that meditation may be practiced even by an atheist, let alone an agnostic, and yet the same benefits may be obtained. Undoubtedly, the introduction of a carefully considered, simplified, non-religious and impeccable technique of meditation as an adjunct to right living should prove highly advantageous to the modern world and especially to the modern Western world. Such a system ought to be purely rational and purged of all the absurd superstitions often attached to yoga in India. The deep need for it becomes more urgent every year. In the feverish strain and harsh struggle of European and American life, meditation, as a method of developing the ability to keep out disturbing thoughts, securing better emotional balance, calming fretting fears and attaining pleasurable inner peace, would seem to be a paramount necessity. Its introduction as a part of daily living deserves strong advocacy. Its exercises could and should be introduced at a suitable age into the educational curricula of high schools and colleges to discipline the students' minds and concentrate their thoughts. But the ignorant prejudices of parents, the suspicious attitude of ecclesiastics and the complete unfamiliarity of pupils themselves erect high barriers to the consummation of this important project. A summary of mysticism. Such is the second degree in man's ascension to truth. Mysticism might be cryptically described as a mode of life which claims, without long and laudatory praises of God, to bring us nearer to FJM than do ordinary religious methods, as a view of life which rejects the all-too-human God made by man in his own image and out of his own imagination, replacing it by a formless infinite divinity, and as a psychological technique which seeks to establish direct communication with this spirit, through the channel of interior contemplation. Certain collective tenets of mysticism are not confined to any one faith, to any one country or to any one people, and are roughly universal. These cardinal positions of the mystic's thought are five in number and may be briefly picked out and exhibited as follows. Mystics hold first that God is not to be located in any particular place, church or temple, but that his spirit is everywhere present in nature and that nature everywhere abides in it. The orthodox notion that God is a particular person among many other persons, only much more powerful, yet still saddled with likes and dislikes, anger and jealousy, is rejected as childish. Pantheism is therefore the initial note to be sounded. Right thought hallows a place or makes it profane, and real sacredness dwells within the mind alone. Next, they hold that as a corollary from the first tenet, God abides inside the heart of every man as the sun abides in all its myriad rays. He is not merely a physical body alone, as materialists believe, nor a body plus a ghost-like soul which emanates from it after death, as religionists believe, but he is here and now divine in the very flesh. The heavenly kingdom must be found whilst we are yet alive, or not at all. It is not a prize which is bestowed on us in the nebulous courts of death. The practical consequence of this doctrine is embodied in the third tenet of the Epistics, which asserts that it is perfectly possible for any man, who will submit to the prerequisite ascetic discipline, to enter into direct communion by contemplation and meditation with the Spirit of God without the use of any priest or prelate as an intermediary and without the formal utterance of verbal prayer. This renders it quite unnecessary to lift upturned palms in suppliant adjuration of a higher being. Silent aspiration thus replaces mechanical recitation. The fourth tenet is as obnoxious to official religion as the last, for it declares that the stories, events, incidents and sayings, which in their totality constitute a holy scripture, are merely a mixture of imagined allegories and actual happenings, a literary concoction whereby mystical truths are cleverly conveyed through the medium of symbolic myth, legendary personification and true historic fact, that the 20th century indeed could quite justifiably write its new Bibles, its new Qurans, its new Vedas afresh if it wished, for the divine afflatus may descend again at any hour. Mystics hold, fifthly, that their practices ultimately lead to the development of supernormal faculties and extraordinary mental powers or even strange physical ones, either as the gift of God's grace or as the consequence of their own efforts. It will be plain that when mystical ecstasy is strong, it must logically lead a man to regard himself as a bearer of divinity and in extreme cases as deity itself. Thus a renowned Mohammedan Sufi mystic exclaimed to the astonished people of Baghdad, 1,000 years ago, "I am God." Unfortunately, the caliph thought otherwise, and punished his impiety with Neronian tortures, finally throwing his body into the Tigris. Such was the fate of the celebrated Hallaj. The broadening effect of mysticism upon men's religious outlook is an incentive to tolerance and therefore a definite asset in this intolerant world. To take the Bible, for instance, as the sole authentic basis of religious truth, completely ignoring the possibility that other races, such as the Hindus or the Chinese, have produced scriptures which deserve at least an equal claim to consideration, is a narrow view. This religious bigotry, which can see no other faith than its own, is out of place in our broader time, when the study of comparative religion can demonstrate amply the family ties between the world's faiths. Religious loftiness is not the exclusive possession of any single man, movement or race. The fully developed mystic understands that God's sun shines on all alike, and that he is free to follow any particular creed or none. That which he seeks he must discover for himself, and from himself by meditative introversion. The inspirer or founder of a religious cult who is really advanced would know how to grade his hearers and devotees, when to give the populace entry to the first degree but no farther, and when to give the more mystically minded entry to the second degree. / may take the words of Jesus as an example of this knowledge, when he said to his closest disciples, "To you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God, but to them it is not given. Therefore I speak to them in allegories, because hearing, they hear not, neither do they understand." The word mysteries in the original has the meaning of formerly hidden but now revealed, whilst Moffat has not hesitated to render it as secret truth in his translation of the New Testament. But such mysteries have no reference to philosophy. That Jesus instructed some of his personal followers, and through them the later apostles, in the tenets and practices of the second degree, that is yoga and mysticism, there is ample evidence in the words and lives of his early followers, such as in the mystic trances of John and the mystical sentences of Paul. This merely mystical understanding of truth on their part brought certain defects into their own teachings later, as well as certain misapprehensions of the real nature of Jesus' personality, defects and errors which the later Gnostic philosophers saw up to a degree and tried to remedy. But if the history and mystery of Jesus baffled his own people, we need not be surprised that they have baffled the whole world since. A careful perusal of the New Testament sections will show that although most of them may conveniently be classified as first degree, that is purely religious matter. There is also a thin vein of mysticism of the second degree running right through them. For instance, the sentence "the kingdom of heaven is within you" has absolutely no connection whatever with official religion and entirely refers to the experiences of yogis and mystics. The explanation why such a mixture of concepts exists is twofold. Firstly, the compilation of these records in a single volume did not occur until a few hundred years after Jesus is believed to have passed away. The obscure Council of Nicaea found numerous Gospels extant when it sat to make the compilation, consisting of a mixed collection of religious books intended for the masses and mystical ones intended for the elect few. The immense number of bishops who constituted this council had quite a fight over the nature of Christ. They naturally made their selections and rejections according to their personal temperaments and outlook. Hence the somewhat uneven selection of authentic footnote, the official account of the miraculous self-movement and self-classification of the books during the darkness of night may be dismissed for what it was, a churlish tale intended to impress the ignorant. Gospels and unjustifiable rejection of certain apocrypha. Secondly, Jesus was in revolt against the stiff orthodoxy of the Jewish priests, most of whom were not only ignorant of the higher degree themselves but deliberately persecuted those who were mystically inclined. His indignation expressed itself in the words, "Woe unto you! Ye entered not in yourselves, and them that were entering ye prevented." It is evident that his sympathy with the ignorant helpless masses was so large and overwhelming that he deliberately opened the doors of the higher mystical teaching to a little extent for them, although only his close disciples were fully initiated. Buddha was undoubtedly actuated by precisely the same feelings and opened the same doors even wider than did Jesus. Hardly an ancient people existed but cherished its mystical tenets. When we search their more recondite records, we find that nearly all exclaim with Epicurus, "Gods exist but they are not what the common people suppose them to be." Similar notions are known in certain high quarters of some world religions even today, but closed lips are usually maintained about them. The Vatican knows how to keep its historical secrets and to guard its store of rare mystical manuscripts and books. Some were not a little surprised at the frankness of the significant confession recently made by a former dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, London, when he publicly said, "As for repudiating obsolete dogmas, it is very difficult. We have no right to offend these little ones that believe. It is perfectly hopeless to try to compose a creed which will satisfy both a learned scholar and his kitchen maid. Mysticism is not enough, but the law of life is movement. Men cannot remain immobile like a hibernating toad in prolonged trance. He has to get out of it at some time or other. He has to associate with his fellow mystics or with his family or with the world at large. Or he has to attend to one physical need or another. Moreover, he will sooner or later be brought up against the various limitations of mysticism and the characteristic defects of mystics. Some of them are serious and important. The seeker who has never met with them, or having met them has never had the courage to face them adequately, can never rise beyond the second grade, but will put a premature end to his quest and remain a smug and self-satisfied undergraduate." As this chapter deals only with the practical value of mysticism and not its philosophical or truth value, consideration of problems involving the latter must be deferred to a later one. Thus will the seeker one day arrive at the wall which limits the range of mysticism. He will see that, whatever good it can do, there is much that it cannot do yet wrongly claims to do. He will see, further, that the social value of historic mysticism is as little as its individual value is great, and therefore it cannot constitute a complete solution of the problem of human existence, or offer a complete panacea for the malady of human suffering. He will turn in disgust or disillusionment from the veiled exploitation of their followers' ignorance, credulity, financial resources, diseases, anxieties or desires by most of those who profess to teach this subject or who proclaim their competency to guide its aspirants. He will ask why it is that such harmful charlatanries and gross superstitions have clouded the sky of mysticism's history. The final view can only be that the very possibility of these defects reveals the insufficiency and limitations of mysticism. On its meritorious side, it is admirable, yet it is not perfect. There is something lacking in it. That missing element is precisely the same as the missing element in religion. The one makes its direct appeal to emotional faith, the other to emotional experience. Neither makes an appeal to the criterion of highest truth. Both lack a rational foundation and even glory in their lack. For him who breathes the rarefied atmosphere of truth, no charlatanry, no superstition and no exploitation can ever be possible. He will not permit self-deception to touch him and will certainly never knowingly deceive others. The variations and contradictions of mystical experience necessarily indicate that ultimate truth must lie beyond its province. For there must be one such truth of life, not two or more. The ethical failures of mystics and occultists must be attributed to their personal failures to discover and realize this supreme truth, and to their dependence on an unstable and uncertain source of inspiration, viz. Feeling, which is notoriously changeable no matter how exalted it becomes temporarily by contemplation. Their intellectual difficulties are the logical result of their disdain of logic and of their inner opposition to tested rational processes in preference to debatable intuitive ones. It is clear that he who seeks the highest must one day make up his mind to travel farther than mysticism, however useful and necessary a stage of his onward journey it has been, and must always remain. The inability to obtain satisfactory and convincing answers to such questions as fullness of experience and love of knowledge will eventually arouse must lead the thoughtful inquiring mystic who has not settled down into smug self-laudation or conservative quiescence to a wilderness where he will walk in lonely bafflement for a time, just as once he may have walked into the wilderness of doubt, despair and skepticism when he emerged from the self-contradictions of dogmatic religion. The operation of reversing gear, from surrender to mystical feeling to sharp self-criticism by reason, for a man who has driven for years in the former is neither easy nor quick to make. Some time lag will be needed for its accomplishment, and the principle of gradualness will hold good here. Could he but know it, the very discontent which has crept into his mind is a harbinger of his close approach to the invisible frontier of a higher region of thought. Yet the frontier will remain closed to him unless he persevere with his solitary journey and refuse to be held back by old habits or other opinion. The courage which is required from him now is not less than that which he needed in that earlier momentous escape from religion or agnosticism to mysticism. Few were ready to accompany him then, but he must expect infinitely fewer still to accompany him now into this howling wilderness. But if he keeps in view the gravity of his undertaking, he will not flinch from acceding to these requirements. He will come to perceive, if dimly, that the inner urge which imperiously drives him out must be respected beyond all else, for its ineffably holiness is something far beyond the imputed holiness of religious faith or mystic intuition. The elementary position of all religious and mystical systems becomes clear, therefore, when they are coordinated in the larger conceptions of philosophy. Whatever of truth they contain is but the symbolic translation of subtle philosophical tenets. The pious confections of a humanized God afford useful pabulum for common folk. The peaceful reveries of meditation are benedictions to more evolved minds. But to both of these classes the caviar-like food of a moral, emotional or intellectual elite is inevitably cold and unattractive. So the mystic whose motto is Excelsior, must suffer and struggle, even amidst the frequent if fitful interludes of contemplative peace which he has now attained. The moment will arrive when he will stand at the very gate of the frontier itself. A few more paces and he may stride across it. Beyond lies a new land, vastly mysterious and hardly trodden. It is the region of the third degree, the empire of the supreme wisdom open to man. Yet he will not know how close he is to it unless a guide now appears to make the revelation and to escort him farther. The guide may be an ancient one and speak to him across the generations through the inscribed pages of a manuscript or the printed pages of a book, or he may be a living one and speak to him face to face. The first is a chart which may take him slowly some of the way, while the second will take him quicker and farther. But once the new journey has begun and the frontier lies behind him, he will never again know the meaning of complacent rest or selfish ease. For the new acolyte of the Absolute must now struggle incessantly, first towards his own final position and then for the beneficent liberation of others, under the authoritative command of a superior power, Truth. Chapter 4, The Hidden Philosophy of India. The readers who come with a kindly attitude to these chapters do not come with a prepared one. It is to be feared that some propositions must have startled them and others must have alarmed them. But the teachings which are yet to be set down will come as a surprise to those who have relished the writer's narratives of yogic adventure or accounts of mystic experience. Let them bear patiently, however, for in the end they will find that all the real gold in religion and mysticism will not be lost and that full assay value will be returned for their patience. All that is admirable in religion and well serves toiling mankind shall here be well respected too. All that makes mysticism a boon to struggling individuals shall receive the favorable evaluation it merits. Our scales are just. Nevertheless, they cannot be deceived. They will not accept the spurious along with the genuine or the factitious with the factual. Nor will they permit the detrimental to crowd into their pans under the shelter of the beneficial. Although the appeal of these pages shall be made only to rational understanding and not to sentimental faith and credulity, nor even to easily stirred imagination, such is the distinctive amplitude of truth that it covers all things with its comprehensiveness. An undreamed of unity, a sublime synthesis bringing together the real, the true, the good and the beautiful, awaits them at the end. The endless wars of doctrine and the bestial hatreds of men here find their last grave. The relation of philosophy to religion has been considered and its relation to mysticism has been freely hinted at. The interrelations of all three are such that if religion be regarded as the vestibule of mysticism, the latter will occupy the same position with reference to philosophy. However, it is here necessary to bring out more clearly the relationship of the hidden philosophy towards what is frequently but often erroneously termed philosophy in both the West and the East. This demands some preliminary reflection upon the general meaning of the term. No tortured animal has ever asked with benignant Buddha why universal suffering existed, or has ever gone behind momentary appearances and asked what larger meaning underlay the enigma of life. Man alone of all living species has done this. The monkey is the animal most nearly like man, yet the ethical conflicts of religion, the aesthetic appreciation of art and the tormenting questions of philosophy have never entered its head. What then is the most marked difference between the mind of a man and the mind of a monkey? Most animals certainly have thoughts and retain memories, whilst many undoubtedly possess intelligence. Some, like the Indian elephant, possess an extremely high degree of intelligence. But there is one thing which no animal can ever do, and that is to use its intelligence in the abstract. It cannot reason theoretically nor bring reflection to transcend its physical environment. Its actions are invariably determined by the concrete conditions which surround it. A further mental activity which lies beyond the intelligence of the most intelligent animal in the world is to think impersonally. No animal has ever been known to attempt to communicate with another animal dwelling on a different and remote continent, because none feels the need of troubling about those who do not touch its immediate environment or are unlikely to touch it at some time. This implies that it cannot rise beyond individuality into impersonality, the cause being its inability to bring an isolated item of its experience into proper relation with the universe. It cannot stand away from its own body and contemplate with complete selfless detachment the character, nature and life of another beast moving 100 yards away, let alone the stars overhead when they appear at night. For every beast, the primordial needs of the body are its chief concern. The hub of its universe around which everything revolves, is and forever remains itself, and all other creatures are reacted to according to their relation to its own fears, desires, etc. Life is a simple fact for such a creature, whereas the intellect of man is fated to create problems and then torture itself trying to solve them. Man alone has deemed it worthwhile to agitate his mind and do all these things. He alone is provoked by the universe interposing questions and seeking their answers, which proves that he possesses distinctive mental faculties which are denied to animals. And the sum of those faculties is nothing more than the thinking power developed not only to a higher degree but also to an abstract impersonal level. Man's intellect may rise into purely theoretical activity, it may engage itself in the most impersonal studies like astronomy LU and trace the movements of remote planets, it may disdain the exigencies of cramping material surroundings and soar aloft into questions concerning the cause and course of the entire structure of the universe, whilst it can take the facts and items of experience and by constant reflection relate them into rational connections, finally weaving them into a comprehensive and systematic pattern of explanation. When we seek the significance of all this, we have to conclude that an opportunity has been vouchsafed to man alone to possess the capacity of arousing interest in, inquiring into, reflecting upon and perhaps eventually understanding the truth about his own life, as well as the surrounding universe. No insect, no plant, no animal possesses this unique and lofty privilege of seeking truth and reflecting upon it. Vasishtha, an ancient Indian sage, exclaimed, "Better the rock-bound toad, better the crawling earthworm, better the blind cave serpent, than the man without inquiry / such inquiry is called philosophy." But let nobody think that philosophy is something to be chosen by a man when it so pleases him, on the contrary, it chooses him. The very fact that he is a human and not an animal being has perforce made him a philosopher, albeit an unconscious one. True, he did not ask for this distinction, but he cannot escape it. The first few crude disjointed thoughts about his environment which floated through the mind of the earliest savage, the primitive odd pieces of knowledge about himself and other men which he picked up during brief hazy reflections, the wonderment and adoration which the advent of the morning sun always stirred in him, these were the beginnings of a mental life which distinguished man from beast and marked his early unwitting steps in that quest of wisdom to whose last and final stage he one day awakens and affixes the name of philosophy. Then his attitude becomes a conscious and reasoned one, then it attains high rank. Henceforth his movements are no longer slow, groping and blundering, but quick and direct. By asking abstract questions, by inquiring deeply into universal existence, he shows how far he has traveled beyond the brutes. But the quest is really a unity, even though it may be divided into these two clearly defined stages. Everybody therefore is something of an actual philosopher, even if he be an imperfect, inarticulate and inchoate one. It has already been explained why religion is an elementary initiation into an inferior form of philosophy, and hence every religious person likewise comes under this category. Only he prefers parables where the intelligentsia demand reasoned explanations. The businessman who is too busy to trouble his head with such barren and worthless intellectual fabrication as he deems philosophy to be nevertheless possesses his own outlook on life, his own views as to what he is here for and how far matter is real. He may believe that there is no meaning in the cosmic masquerade, that the essential purpose of his incarnation is solely an economic one. He may regard the chair in which he sits as being possessed of a materiality which is so obvious as to be beyond a single moment's consideration or question. Whether these views are correct or not is beside the point, for the mere act of holding them proves that he too, like the academic metaphysician whom he contemptuously despises or ignores, has a philosophy. Moreover, it influences his conduct and possesses a practical bearing on his life just as much as the other man's. Thus we arrive at the little-known truth that the ordinary man's criticism at philosophical reflection is utterly useless and that the points at issue with which philosophers struggle are meaningless and trivial is itself the outcome of philosophical reflection. He is using the same method which the philosophers use, albeit crudely. The barrenness of practical results and the lack of settled conclusions of which he complains in philosophy are partly due to the fact that philosophers are much more cautious in approach, much less hasty in procedure, much more clear-seeing in mentality to be willing to arrive at the premature judgments which please him. Even the very wording of his own criticism itself constitutes a conclusion reached by generalized logical thinking upon given facts, which is precisely the method used by philosophy. Therefore his judgment against philosophy is itself invalidated by the way in which it is obtained. Moreover, he has to think about life whether he likes to or not and whether he wants to or not, because the most commonplace facts and circumstances of his personal existence demand some thought, however little, about them and their meaning.